Hey, Anthony.
Jesse, hello there.
How do you do,
Guess where
sir?
I am?
Where are you?
I'm in Miami,
Oh, how
Florida.
nice. How's the weather?
Beautiful. It's gorgeous.
And are you
I'm in the Dykes Project Pavilion.
nice. Are you hanging out with hedge fund managers?
Campari
Campari
on ice. Wearing white linen.
on ice. Awesome. Well, tell me about the fair.
Tiny
Nice.
sunglasses that
That sounds awesome. Welcome to the Aphorists. This is December 9th, 2012, and we are recording in our Dog Patch studio. I'm Jesse Holding with my Aphorist number two, Anthony Ryan. Hello,
Why am
Anthony.
I number two?
Because I'm number one.
Okie
Get used to it. You should be by now.
Is it alphabetical?
No, not really.
Okay.
There's an internal ranking system that.
Is it gonna vary, or
No, you're
am I
always
just I'm
aphorist number.
permanently here?
You're permanently aphorist number two.
Okay.
So today we are talking about, among other things, Miami Basel. Basel? Basel?
Basel.
How do you say it?
Basel.
Basel. The art fair. I'm
Fawlty
actually.
Towers reference.
A Fawlty Towers reference, nice. Obscure.
Relatively.
Relatively. I actually have some drawings at the Aqua Fair, K
You
Imperial.
do?
Yeah, K Imperial.
Oh,
Brought some truck
then
drawings.
you are
I've
at
arrived.
Miami.
I've
Yeah.
arrived. I'm at Miami. I'm
Damn.
in the building. I mean, my work could be in a cardboard box for all I know, but
Yeah.
they flew it to Miami.
Okay.
So my work has been shipped, as far as I know, to Miami.
That's
Very
exciting.
exciting. Don't know what's going to
You waited
happen.
for the podcast to spring that on me so I would
Yeah.
sound all impressed.
Yeah, exactly.
I am
Well,
impressed.
just
Wow.
another way for me to sound superior to
Yeah.
you. That's my goal. Keep
To
you in your place.
reassert your elf dog status.
That's right. So we did a little reading to talk to get this kicking this off. Now, I have to say I've never physically been to Miami Basel. Have you? Have you been to the art fair?
No.
Now,
I've
have
never
you
been
been?
to a single art fair.
You're not even to the San Francisco art fairs?
Oh, yeah, I guess that counts.
Sort of.
I've never been to the major ones,
Right,
Armory or anything.
right, right. Yeah,
Venice.
I've never
Well, I
been.
guess that's a Biennale.
That's a Biennale.
Sorry.
That's not a fair.
Yeah.
I mean, it sets the tone for the fair, but probably. But
Right, right.
so, Anthony sent me the New York Times article that came out by Patricia Cohen on December 7th, and we'll put a link up to this on our page. Basically, talking about how several prominent art writers and critics, including Sarah Thornton, Felix Salmon, Will Gompertz, and Dave Hickey, have been attacking the art world and arguing that there's been a major distortion of late. By the sort of hedge fund managers and other,
Oligarchs, they seem to
oligarchs.
be.
Yeah,
That
they
was an
didn't
angle that I didn't think
really.
about. And
Yeah,
who,
Sarah Thornton talks about it, but a couple
right,
other
people
people.
that have made money in, non-democracies
Right,
where
right. So,
there's,
yeah,
you know,
major human rights violations. So we're
the
talking about
definition of filthy lucre. Whose quote was
that?
that?
That was Sarah Thornton.
Mm.
So that's, millionaires and billionaires competing to spend money in auctions as a for art as a way of sort of the it seems like it's a clear cut way for there to be a winner and a loser when it comes to how much money you can spend on an object. And so they're critical of this. Sarah Thornton actually brings up some interesting points about how there's no investigation or she's making allegations without much proof, I guess, of the fact that there's essentially money laundering and other kinds of
She's not making
really
allegations because she's presupposing that such allegations would be libelous because she probably can't prove them.
right. They're difficult to prove because no one in the market will talk about them.
Well, and the art market
So,
is largely unregulated.
right, it's totally
Oh, it is
unregulated,
totally.
right? Yeah,
It's the
yeah.
Wild West.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Sarah Thornton says in her, so she's gotten, and we'll put a link up to this, top 10 reasons not to write about the art market. Number five, oligarchs and dictators are not cool. I have no problem with the rich people. Some of my best friends are high net worth individuals. But amongst the biggest spenders in the art market right now are people who have made their money in non-democracies with horrendous human rights records. Their expertise in rising to the top of a corrupt system gives punch to the term filthy lucre.
Okay, so I'm...
These Russian, Arab, and Chinese collectors bring liquidity to the art market and allows more artists and curators and critics to make a living in relationship to art. So that is maybe a potential plus to it. So what were you hoping?
That you would educate me, because I don't know that much about art fairs. Like, who goes to them? And do auction houses have a presence at... Does Christie's have a presence?
I'd be surprised if they do. I don't know. Maybe when Randy calls in, we can ask him. You know, there's this great book written by an economist named Don Thompson. And he wrote a book called The $12 Million Stuff Shark, The Curious Economics of Contemporary Art. And, you know, he basically – now, this came out a couple years ago – but he basically details very explicitly how the market works, and that you know, like the top 25. You know, he breaks down how the cake metaphor that Gail Dawson uses is pretty accurate. So she says that, like, at the it's a multi-layered cake, right? So at the base of the cake, you've got this huge
cake.
You have this huge base, and that's like every artist, right? And then the next layer up, you've got artists who are, you know, maybe represented and making some...
Probably,
you know,
academics, too.
Yeah.
They support themselves by some other means that's art-related.
Right. And then you've got the next tier up, which is people who can make a living on their art, but it's...
Six figures, she says.
This person really breaks it down. And then you've got the top level, which is the very top of the cake, which is very small layer, and that's the high-end, the super high-end people. So
the Paul McCarthy's and the...
Yeah, I don't know.
Damien Hirst's and the...
Right, Damien Hirst would be a perfect example of, you know... So, like, as an artist, you know, I used to think, actually, especially before I read this book, I really used to think that you know, I used to think about the art world in sort of one way, which was I'm passionate about making and I'm going to do it. And maybe with enough work, I can enough hard work and make good enough, you know, attractive enough, whatever that means, artwork that I might be able to someday make a living at it. And then
can I just insert an aside here? Yeah. I mean, this is just a funny little memory that I have, which when we were in grad school together very early on, before I knew you at all, really, well, you still intimidated me. No, you don't. Sadly.
I'm slipping.
There was a guy, do you remember this lecture? There was a visiting artist. I don't remember his name. He was one of those guys who was at MIT in the 70s, and he was... anyway, he was I'll see if I can find the name. He did this piece in the early 80s at SF MoMA where he would do these really like clever things with a film camera where he filmed this room with people in it and objects in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he on this rotating apparatus in the center of the room.
Okay.
And then he removed the people from the room and painted all the objects white.
Oh, yes,
and then
yes,
he put
yes,
a camera
yeah,
on the
yeah,
same
I do remember that, yeah.
Apparatus.
And then projected.
And then it projected
right.
all the objects that were then missing from the room or
yeah.
surfaces.
Yep, yep. I remember that. Yeah, that
anyway, was I remember at the beginning of the lecture he asked, how many of you intend to make a living as an artist?
Uh-huh.
And I don't know who raised their hand. I don't even know if I raised my hand.
Uh-huh.
But I know that you raised your hand.
Yeah, yeah.
And I noticed it.
Yeah.
And made note of it.
What did he say to that? I don't have any... I mean, I don't remember that moment.
I think he was fairly encouraging. I don't really remember beyond that.
Uh-huh.
It's funny that I just... The only part of that I really remember
right,
was...
Right, right. How did I intimidate
you? Raising your hand. Because in seminar, you were like, dude with the stopwatch.
Well, I was a hard ass, yeah.
And you were... Yeah, just very articulate, very calm, and like uber rational. Something's on change. That's a little intimidating. I was intimidated by the whole experience.
Oh, right.
But I feel like you were already in the program when I got there.
Right, right. But it's funny because I feel like I really tried. I made a major effort to like encourage the new students, the people, the new folks. Right. The mm-hmm. like me and Luna threw that barbecue for the first years.
And I'm not saying this is anything on your
right, right, right. No, but it's just curious. It's just sort of, yeah, no, that's fine. Well, I mean, in seminar, it was just sort of like I had spent.
And I know what the fuck you were talking about with your Cone of the Unknown. I'm like, what the hell? What the hell is this guy talking about?
That's right. I just remember my first year listening to like certain people who I will not name. Going on and on and on, and never, ever, not everybody would get a chance to talk because somebody would talk for 30 minutes and then you'd get like a minute when you were working with a visiting artist or whatever.
So now I need to know.
I'll tell you later.
Okay.
I don't give a fuck actually. So Cassandra Sobrieski or whatever her name was. You know, like, I remember we had a visiting artist, Kim Ano came. I think she graduated before you started. Yeah, anyway, yeah, but, like, Kim Ano was, like, a visiting artist. And yeah. So we had an opportunity to present.
Barbara probably brought her in.
Yeah. But we had an opportunity to present to her, and she went first and basically, like, shot the hour for every, you know, like, we had a certain period of time. There was, like, 15 people in the class.
What, you're all waiting out in the hallway?
No, we're all just sitting there listening to her present her, like, her myriad of ideas. And it was just like, holy fuck, you know, you just, like, you just ruined this opportunity for everybody, basically. Yeah. And so, like, I vowed that once I had some say in the matter, which I figured out a way to do, you know, starting my second year, that we would take the number of people in the class, the hour of the time that we had, divide it evenly, and then be, you know, very disciplined about
it was good.
And
it
actually,
good.
It's really good too because, you know, if you're forced to convey your ideas in 10 or 15 minutes, which is still actually a really long time, then there's that's plenty of
and
time.
And you know how long that actually is.
Right. Exactly.
And that's valuable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for folks that weren't prepared, you know, they had their feelings hurt periodically, but yeah. Anyway, it's interesting that I raised my hand and that you have that memory of that. That's really fascinating, actually. I vaguely remember that guy presenting, but I don't remember that question, and I don't remember raising my hand. I wouldn't obviously raise my hand today. I mean, clearly I've learned that, you know, even if I am, you know, doing actually all right or better than I thought I would be doing, you know, a couple years ago.
Yeah.
I was very optimistic, obviously, when I was in grad school.
I really liked that you did that.
Maybe naive, right.
I think it, like I said, I was a little intimidated by you and just the fact that you did that, like, I think like, you know, oftentimes people like in grad school or whatever, like you try to seem cool and
right,
you know, and
right.
I thought it was very yeah, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I had a really clear plan.
It was
like,
a little disarming.
Was it
right? Yeah. On.
I mean, I had a very clear plan of I was going to spend half my time in San Francisco and half my time in New York.
Yeah, I remember that.
And
you expressed that.
Yep. No, that was my plan at the time, and then. You know, I was, you know, like after graduating, I started showing a lot. You know, I had a solo show on the East Coast in a gallery in Newark. I was in a group show, and then they gave me a solo show. I had a solo show here at the lab.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I sort of had this, I don't know if it's a crisis, but after my solo show at the lab, so it had been 3 intense years of grad school and then 2 intense years of showing, where I was using all my vacation time to show my, you know, to do installations. And, you know, I was still working at this corporate job, so I was working 40 plus hours a week at that, as I had done the entire time through grad school.
Yeah.
So then, you know, after my solo show at the lab, Amanda and I went on a trip, my first trip out of the country. So I just got my passport. It was the first trip we really took, was to Mexico, and we went to Isla Mujeres. And, which is gorgeous. and it's the East.
That was the first time in your life you had traveled abroad?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
That's cool.
Yeah. So I remember, you know, being in Mexico, being on this island, and, you know, Amanda and I hadn't really seen each other in any kind of real way for 5 years.
Wow.
Like, literally, yeah, at some level. She's a partner in her law firm, and I was going to grad school and working full time. And, you know, it was just like, I had this, you know, incredible, what I thought, you know, I put on a pretty ambitious show at the lab, and a lot of people came and saw it, but then sort of nothing, you know, nothing really happened as a result, mm-hmm. right? And I remember thinking like, oh, no one cares if I make work or not, you know? Like, if I stopped making work, the art world and nobody would really care.
It'll keep turning.
The world keeps going along, and I'm just one more tooth in a very large cog. And you know, that is sort of like the reality of what it takes to be an artist became clear to me in a way that it hadn't, you know, previously.
Because your expectation was what?
You know, I guess I expected that I would, you know, I guess I don't know what my expectations were. I mean, if I look back in retrospect, I guess I wasn't very thoughtful about it. And just in terms of like the, you know, I'd have grown up going to museums, I'd gone up going to galleries. I just assumed that like I'd pop into that slot somehow, right? Mm-hmm. That if I would make interesting work that, you know, that opportunities would come, but I didn't really understand how, like, the mechanics of the art world in any real kind of way. I just figured you should just start showing a lot. You'd start off in group shows, start to get solo shows, then, like, you know, then avenues would open up and you'd choose the direction. But, you know, then I started sharing studio space with, you know, Mike Arcega, became good friends with Christian Maycheck, and saw, like, you know, those guys had gallery representation, you know, and both had, you know, all had jobs. And basically every artist I met that was doing, by my standard, you know, by sort of all standards,
yeah,
you
reasonable,
know,
amount of success.
Reasonable amount of success, you know, they were living essentially hand to mouth, you know, very, you know, didn't have savings accounts, didn't have anything that would remotely look like kind of financial stability. Meanwhile, I, you know, and you know, weren't making enough on art sales to do more than just sort of like break even after paying studio rent and materials and all that stuff. So that was a big surprise to me. And I thought, okay, so what's a sustainable art career look like? And then what does it mean to participate in this world, you know? So from my sort of naive calculations of like, yeah, I'm going to make a living as an artist, to the reality of, well, I mean, how does one even do that? And what, you know, you can have a strategy that may or may not work. And then, you know, you go from there. But, I even know, you know, there are certain people who have, you know, I look at like Jessica Stockholder, who used to teach at Yale and now teaches in Chicago, and, you know, has a really pretty great art career, collected in a lot of museums. Obviously, her work sells in galleries, but it's like you got to be a professor at some level too, you know? Like, so that's that next one up, that next level up of the cake, right? It's below the top tier, it's above that bottom. You know,
but there's an interim tier,
right?
Wasn't there?
Well, let's,
there's like,
yeah,
the,
yeah,
top, and then there's the people making a living, and then there's the people dividing their living between art sales and
right.
That's the model.
So this guy Don Thompson breaks it down. Like,
so can I just play off what you just said?
Yeah, please.
Just because just in relation to my own view of like an art career, you know, it's like. I never expected to make a living at it. Like, in undergrad, I just always understood that.
Mm.
And I think it's part of, like, just my my sort of fatalistic upbringing, you know, like. But I always felt that I knew that I would have to sort of have a day job, whatever. And weirdly, my sort of fatalistic pessimism sort of enabled me to just sort of stick it out.
Right.
Never.
That's great.
Had any, I never had any strong expectations in terms of a career. And it also, I always valued, it enabled me to value, like, these other aspects of, like, of being an artist that have to do with community. And, you know, just being involved with various arts organizations. You know, like artists cooperatives as I have been. Yeah. So, you know, I was too far in the other direction, perhaps. Like, I maybe should have taken, you know, it would have been better if I took my ability to actually sell work, which I do, you know, occasionally sell work, like a little more seriously, you know, and I think I am as I grow as an artist, I'm like thinking about that more.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because it's like, you know, what is it when you start seeing yourself in terms of the context of how the art market works? That's one way of perceiving your trajectory, your career. And then, so what I've come to is to this sort of recognition that, you know, you got to do it for you, and that, you can't make work to be, you know, or I can't, one could, but you know, I can't approach it like, oh, this is going to be like, this is my brand. This is my, you know, I just don't think that way. And it's not satisfying to me. I don't even know what that would look like, you know?
I remember when, I recommended, when I was at State, I recommended for, you know, we would recommend people as visiting artists. And I recommended, Emmanuel Montoya and he came and I think, like, so Emmanuel Montoya is a San Francisco, Bay Area-based artist who, like, he's an interesting guy. Like, you know, he taught at, like, Juvenile Hall in the 80s. You know, he's gotten some, you know, modest public art commissions in the Bay Area at SFO. He's got work in, like, my local library in the Mission District and, like, and I remember at the time, like, I felt a lot of sort of unease around him being there because I felt like it was sort of my choice and I feel like it reflected on me. So, like, when some of the grads sort of grumbled about him and thought that he wasn't up to snuff. Like, in terms of, representing sort of an art career that they would want to model themselves after. So sort of modest. And I remember Sarah, you know, sort of bemoaning this to my wife. And she said, like, you know, there are a lot of different ways of being an artist. And this is like a valuable sort of way to look at that. You know, and, you know, Emmanuel had a lot of ups and downs, whatever. And he's very close to, like, you know, the ground and in terms of being an artist, being connected to the community. And, yeah, I think for people in school, it's valuable to see, like, these different modes of being an artist. Throughout your life.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think I wish that I had read the Don Thompson book in grad school because I think it would have been a good leveler in some way, you know, to sort of, like, and maybe not. Maybe like if I didn't have this aspiration that maybe I wouldn't, I don't know if it would have affected the way I worked or the way I approach things. You know, it's funny. I don't know. But now that I've read that book, once I did read that book, I was like, oh, okay, I get it. That's why this is the way it is. And now I just have to be okay with what I'm doing and whatever successes come my way, they come my way. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I can say that I have a very satisfying art practice now.
Yeah.
And I also realize that, you know, I still remember that lesson, which is the art world doesn't care whether I keep making work or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, it's like I can participate when, as long as I'm producing, right? But as soon as I stop, it doesn't matter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And people don't. This guy writes, the art market looks pretty healthy from the standpoint of a branded artist represented by a branded dealer, and okay from that of an artist represented by a mainstream gallery. What does the market look like from the standpoint of all the non-represented artists, or those selling through local or suburban galleries? Most of those artists see the high-priced art market only through art magazines or art gallery openings and in auction catalogs. There are approximately 40,000 artists resident in London and about the same number in New York, and we're leaving out here any the rest of the country, but this is for this example, he's just using London and New York. Mm-hmm. Of the total of 80,000, 75 are superstar artists with seven-figure incomes. Below those are 300 mature, successful artists who show with major galleries and earn six-figure incomes from art. On the next level down are about 5,000 artists who have some representation, most in mainstream galleries, and who supplement their income through teaching, writing, or supportive partners. There are thought to be 15,000 artists walking the streets of London at any one time looking for gallery representation.
This makes them sound so destitute.
Right. And the same
holding their collar against right. the cold wind.
Right, right. Please, sir, can I have a show? and the same number in New York. This number actually increases each year as publicity given to the high prices paid for contemporary art attracts more young artists to the profession. And those already seeking gallery representation spend longer before dropping out. Greater perceived demand for art results in greater supply of art producers. Whatever the number looking for representation, the superstar gallery ignores them all and bids artists away from other galleries. Mainstream dealers generally pay little attention to those who knock on their doors. Instead, they search for new artists by visiting artist studios and art school graduate shows, or by following recommendations from current gallery artists, collectors, or friends. From these sources and from cold calls, a gallery may see slides or completed works from a dozen new artists a week, but take only one or two a year. Dealers say they pay attention to tips from their own artists and from museum curators, but pay little attention to critics. London dealer Victoria Miro says she follows up recommendations from her artists because she respects their opinions, but seldom takes new artists this way. Another dealer said she sees 1,000 slides a year, visits 50 studios, including 5 to 10 new artists in her group shows, and from that group adds one each year to the list of regular artists represented by the gallery. This is incredibly disheartening for artists involved, virtually all of whom, dealers say, believe themselves to be above average and certainly better than many artists being shown by the dealer reviewing their work.
Material.
Yeah. So, like, that... Those two paragraphs alone, or three, whatever it is, would be... I mean, he's just talking about New York and London. So basically, if you're not in New York and London, you're not going to fit in. You know, that not, you know, basically, you can't make a career. Now, you look at you know, how it is in San Francisco. It's just like a microcosm of that. I don't know what the... But, it, I mean, I think it sounds right. And you, he doesn't even talk about L.A., you know? So... we are,
yeah, weirdly, you would think the LA market is roughly comparable to New York. No, maybe not.
I don't think it is.
No, I guess it's much smaller.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, there's a certain naivete among artists. I sort of object. It's curious to me. I wonder how many artists think of the high prices fetched at Christie's as something to aspire to. Like, is that why you're making art, because you think that your piece is going to sell for $1.3 million at an auction? That seems far-fetched. Now, when...
I remember thinking of Daniel Joseph Martinez. He was also a visiting artist in our program.
I don't know who that is.
He fancies himself a provocateur. He's an artist. Oh. But he's saying, like, even the richest people even the richest artists, like, the money they make is really just, like, lame compared to
a regular, you know, profession. Like,
yeah, or a regular rich person.
Right, right.
Like, it's still
yeah, totally.
Ghetto.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally.
So, like, I don't know, if your goal is to be rich,
don't be an artist. Right.
Yeah.
Or be one of the 20, top 25.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's not, I mean, you know, the thing is that, like, so Sarah Thornton's article, or top 10 reasons why not to write about art, it's just sort of like, or what Hickey and these other people are
not
saying.
Not to write about the art market.
Not to write about the art market. You know, the thing is that it's like, you know, the game's rigged, right? So it's like, it's not, I mean, once you sort of realize, like anything else, that it's not based on merit, right? Like, and that quote he said, you know, you feel like your work is better than the work that's being shown in galleries. And it's like, if being shown in galleries is because it's at some level selling, or the gallerist believes in the artist, their long-term trajectory, right? So,
can you just flatly say it's not based on merit? I don't think I could say that.
It's not based on merit.
Well, who's determining merit?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's... Well, what your idea or my idea, we could agree that so-and-so's a great artist and that they're being, you know, that they're conceptually rigorous, that their work is visually appealing, aesthetic, it's important, they're saying something critical or, you know, they're engaged in a really interesting way, whatever our personal criteria of what makes someone a good artist doesn't necessarily translate into commercial viability, you know what I mean? So it's like, how do you measure
people
success?
That are very successful? Like, even if I don't personally care for their work,
mm-hmm.
like Damien Hirst, for instance, like I don't personally care for that work.
Mm-hmm. Can you say, like, objectively, you think that it's worth the money that it's being paid for?
Well, I think that is impossible to say, but I think I understand his importance.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say, like, mm-hmm. and. There is an audacity and an ambitiousness to what he's trying to do
mm-hmm.
that he seems to do very effectively.
Well, he certainly
not to mention effective. Like part of his whole thing is it's sort of a implicit critique of the art world, right?
In a way. Yeah, it's curious to know if like that's still true.
It's very cynical, right?
Yeah,
isn't
yeah.
it? Can you say that?
I feel like without a compass when I talk about his work. Some of his work I really think is great. And then I think some of like his more recent stuff just like it just feels like you could say either he's being very incredibly cynical and the emperor has no clothes and he's selling the emperor's new clothes, or he's eaten his own dog food and believes his own.
Or
you
all
know,
of the above.
Or all of the above. Yeah, maybe it's not just one thing. Maybe I'm setting up a false dichotomy here.
Yeah.
But,
you know, just as these, like I was saying earlier before we spoke, like numbers only tell part of the story.
Oh, yeah,
you
for
know,
sure,
like,
for sure.
And there's plenty of artists who toil in obscurity for years and years before they attain any success. And mm-hmm. sometimes they're moderately successful and sometimes mm-hmm. they're wildly successful.
Right.
And sometimes it never happens. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. More often than not, it never happens.
Yeah. Well, and so this goes back to my, you know, I wrote about a little, you know, in the Make interview, I talked about sort of like what Arsagan and I were talking about, your art career is not a sprint. It's not even a marathon. It's an ultra marathon. And like, what are you going to do in 5 years, in 10 years, in 15 years? And you know, like, how are you going to, oops, here's Randy. Hey, Randy. So we're joined by Randy Kolosky calling from sunny Florida. How you doing, brother?
Actually, I'm not in Florida. I got back last night.
Oh, really? You're here.
Yep.
So how was it?
It's a really interesting thing to go to.
Yeah.
I learned a lot.
Was this your first time?
Yeah. It's first time having worked there as well.
Oh, you know? Yeah? How did the Ice Nine sculptures do?
There was a lot of interest. They hadn't sold when I left, but I don't know. I'm still... I mean, it's hard to figure out what, like, it's just hard to figure out, like, why people buy what they buy or how they make decisions about it. It's kind of mysterious to me, but Karen seemed to think that there was, you know, some good possibilities. I mean, my feeling was I just wanted to put my best foot forward and make something that I felt really good about, and then whatever happens, happens.
Yeah, you know? That's a great attitude. So, yeah, yeah, totally. Well,
do you have any expectations of anything going there? I think you're setting yourself up.
Right. Well, that's true whether your work's in Miami or just sitting in your studio somewhere. Expectations are are a funny thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So,
But there, it's really revealed. I mean, there, people are, you know, my gallery's at the Aqua Fair, which is like a big hotel. It's like the one they do the thing at the Phoenix Hotel, and people are just, like, all day long, and just filtering in through the room.
Right.
You know, and I wasn't there for, you know, I was stopping in and supposed to drop him off my bag to go swim in the ocean. But, yeah, I mean, it's interesting.
So, did you go to Basel and all the other places?
Yeah.
And
I went to NADA and the big fair, the Miami Basel Fair, and Untitled, which is a smaller, more contemporary fair. It was actually in a big tent on the beach. It was pretty nice, actually.
Right on.
And then Aqua. I didn't get to the fairs across the bay. It was just kind of a hassle. It was all right. I was only there for 3 days.
Right.
It was already a lot of work just to go to the Basel Fair. It's gigantic.
Right.
Can't believe it. No. And you're like turning, you know, every time you turn the corner, it's like giant YouTube artist. No.
Right.
There's like, you know, you go around one corner, it's a giant Tony Craig sculpture, and then you turn another corner and say, you know, I don't know. It's just insane, you know?
Yeah. So do you have a sense of, like, how much work actually sells in that? Like, you know, like a gallery sets up their blue chip artists, and then do buyers come and just, does it all get swooped up? Or do you have a sense of, like, how that operates?
I don't know. It's hard to tell. I mean, everybody, I would ask all the booths, like, hey, how's the fair going for you? And they always were like, oh, it's going well, you know? I didn't really so much gauge that. I was more listening, like, trying to overhear conversations, like, I would hear people having with the gallery people. Like, I mean, this is kind of like a, kind of one example of the kind of thing that I heard over and over again, which was, you know, there would be, like, a couple of dudes, obviously, like, collectors, you know. I remember I went by the Matthew Marks booth at the big fair, and there were two guys looking at a Ken Price sculpture, and they were asking whether it was painted or not, and the guy was explaining how the surface was made on the Ken Price sculpture, but it occurred to me, like, these guys had never even heard of Ken Price, and this was, like, a probably $60,000 or $80,000 sculpture.
Right.
You know, and so I was like, wow, I kind of got the realization that, like, I think there are people there that probably collect it, but I think a lot of it, I think that I was wondering how educated the buying base there really was. It seems like these guys were just attracted to this piece.
Right. They had money.
And I was like, man, Ken Price, iconic. You know, like in the ceramic art world, and, you know, he's one of the few people that crossed over into fine art, and I'm just like, yeah, how could you be buying this work and not know that? I guess it's kind of my feeling about it, but,
yeah.
And then, you know, I think people at the Aqua Fair, it seemed like a little more low-key, like, I think it was, like, some dealers that kind of deal to people regionally, they come and buy stuff for their people, but I don't really know how educated those people really are about who they're buying.
Right,
you know?
Right. Well, I mean, that's what, you know, there's been some recent writing in the New York Times and other people, like, on the web, talking about, like, the role of the advisor, and so you know, like, these hedge fund managers have their millions and billions in there. You know, it's a way to just sort of display your wealth is to, you know, buy at auction and all that stuff. And so then there's, like, this crew of, you know, this class of advisors show up and say, like, here's how you should spend your money. And they all sort of, you know, work together to guide these people with money to buying and sort of establishing the top of the pyramid there. So it's, you don't need to know anything, right, to collect. And in fact, these, you know, advisors will just sort of like smooth the way for you. They're, it's like concierge service or something like that.
Yeah, it was, I don't know. Maybe that's not such a, that's not really such a terrible thing, you know. But it was, I don't know. I just, you know, I guess like as an artist, you hope that people are, you know, buying your work because of some lineage that you have, and I don't really think that's, I think that's true for some people, but I don't,
right.
I think for getting people there, that's not really that important. And I, that was sort of an eye opening.
Right, right.
You know,
so,
like the
so,
gallery, like even like when, you know, like I didn't hear Karen when I was being in the space, like Karen didn't talk about the history of any of my previous work or shows. You know, as far as any of those people knew, that's all I did was make those people.
Right.
You know, and that's it. And I was kind of like, wow, she really knew, you know, kind of, you know, what my practice is. It may be more interesting to you, but I don't know. Maybe it's failed. I don't know if it failed. So
right, right.
There you have it.
Well, you know, it's interesting because to get shows like solo shows or a museum show or whatever, like we as artists have this trajectory, right? That we're, you know, you start off doing group shows and then you start maybe get a solo show at a smaller, like an open place, like a lab or a route, you know, wherever. And then, you know, and then you get a solo show at a, you know, a more prestigious place. Like you had the, your solo show at the Museum of Craft, right? And then,
yeah.
And then it's like, well, what's the next place for you to show, right? Like you're sort of establishing this trajectory of having a good track record of, you know, being ambitious. You know, you get people to write about you.
Man, I've worked very little with galleries.
Right, right,
you know,
right. No, and that's what it's really so I guess my point is like, maybe, you know, it's like, what you're saying is like true. Like it's a tabula rasa when someone walks into a gallery to buy something at an art. Like they don't care. They don't care even necessarily who you are. They just either you like the work or they don't, right? And maybe there's a
which is sort of, I mean, that's kind of a weird thing to me because I think a lot of my work is, you know, and well, that was, I mean, you therein lies some really curious things about these fairs that you know, how accessible, I mean, it's like how accessible is a lot of work and at the different collector bases. I mean, you could write a thesis on, you know, like what people are really responding to or what they're being told to respond to or how accessible is the work. You know, what, like, I mean, you know, there was work there that was really, you know, pretty esoteric work.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you're like, well, who's buying this more esoteric work? Is it a more educated, you know, collector base, or are they just being told that this is cool and that they should buy this?
Right, right, right.
After, you know, I, you know, the person you should really be talking to about this is Amy Freeberg. I mean,
yeah,
I feel like she's the one who really navigates that stuff really well. And then there's just the whole, like, just the whole craziness of Miami. You know?
Right, right.
You know, it's sort of a caricature of itself on some level.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's like music booming from like every, even like the convenience stores have like tech music booming from them, you know.
It's the 24-hour party people.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. I mean, I didn't really participate in a lot of that because I'm an old man now.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, totally.
But, you know, like I walked into one bar, you know, with, you know, really late. Yeah, you don't eat dinner until like 12 o'clock at night. And then, because everything goes until like 8 or 9 o'clock.
Right.
You know? So it's very social. And I walked into a bar and it was blisteringly loud. And I saw people talking to each other and I was like, how can they even communicate?
Right.
So, like, I mean, like people were just screaming at each other at the top of their lungs. It was pretty funny. You know?
That's hilarious.
I was like, wow, awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So do you feel, what do you feel about, like, has your perspective changed dramatically now that you're back? I mean, you probably haven't had a lot of time to think about it, but.
I don't know. It's not gonna, I don't feel like, I think for me, it was like a good first step to go and get familiar. I used to go to art fairs with Chris Johansson when I was working for him, but I think it's different when your work is there.
Right.
You have a different investment in it. Whereas before I was just sort of like a, you know, casual observer. Now I have some investment in it.
Yeah.
I think it was good. I think it was good that I took the time and energy to go and get familiar with it. I don't really feel like I crushed it in any way, like networking or anything. I kind of just went in trying to sort of, sort it out.
Right.
And figure out how this is going to, obviously I'm going to need to participate in this as the future comes on. And so I don't know. For me, it was really just more of a fact-finding mission.
Yeah,
and
no, that's a good approach, a good approach.
Like, my favorite fair was really the Untitled Fair, which I guess is pretty new. Mm-hmm. And it was by far the most contemporary and interesting work. And it was also just, like, strategically and spatially the best fair. Like, the work had the most space.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very, nice... It was, not a fair is really cramped into this, ballroom.
Right.
And everything kind of starts to look... You can really get snowblind at these things.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything starts to kind of look the same.
Yeah.
But I thought the Untitled Fair was super interesting, and I talked to a couple of international galleries there that just brought one artist and kind of did an installation or whatever.
Right.
But it's a really young fair, and it was definitely a lot of very new galleries or people just kind of trying to get a toehold. Into that world.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
It seemed like the thing that was really moving was painting.
Yeah.
I feel like we should all just start making mid-sized paintings.
Yeah, yeah. Like 22 by 30 or 44 by 60 painting, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yep.
Paintings seemed to be the big thing. There was very little sculpture. At least at Aqua, there was very little sculpture.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I guess as an artist, you're impressed with different things.
Yeah.
I'm always really impressed with people's craft. I kind of walked away going, I don't know if people are really that, the collectors are really that concerned about that stuff.
Maybe they are. But, yes.
I always interested in what craft people choose. Right. How they handle something, whether it's, really all over the place or, whatever, or really tight and honed or whatever. But that's sort of, but as an artist, I look at that. I kind of questioned whether the collectors really thought about that.
Right. They probably don't.
They were.
Yep. Yeah, it's interesting.
I got to get back to work.
Okay, thanks.
Well, that was really interesting. I'm glad that Randy had a chance to call in.
Our reporter on the ground.
That's right. Our man on the street.
Letter from Miami.
That's right. It's fascinating, that conclusion there in some ways is we work so hard to build an art career that gets us to the point where we're in a gallery, that the gallery could take us to Miami, and then the people who show up there to buy stuff could give a shit about all that stuff. They're just like, well, you're in a gallery. You must – maybe just that's your bona fide. Bona fide? Bona fides? Whatever. However you pronounce that word.
I know what you mean.
It's like you're there, and then your history doesn't really matter at some point. Mm-hmm. At a certain level. Now, obviously, if you get, an advisor, if you were to get an advisor interested in your work, then they would be like, "Oh, you gotta, you hedge fund manager need to buy this person." But you'd have had to have been selling a lot, Anyway, it's just like you have this idea of the trajectory of your career. And then it sort of has this hits this reset where it sort of doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's either it's pretty and they want to buy it, or it's not. And what's the calculus there for how people buy work or not?
Right,
it's curious. Yeah, I've always thought that painters have it easy. I mean, they have to reconcile reconcile themselves with the history of painting. But when it comes to actually selling work, maybe it's a lot easier for them rather than sculptors.
It's a durable. Just easily presented unit
yeah.
for art.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't know.
Artist.
I don't know.
I always think she's just got such a brilliant thing. She makes these roughly 16 by 20 inch mm-hmm. oil paintings, abstract oil paintings.
Uh-huh.
They're awesome.
Really?
But,
they're accessible.
It's such a perfect unit. And you see a show of her work and it's all
boom.
All the same.
Yeah.
Variations on
it. Yeah, it's genius. It's great.
Yeah, let's get to work. Start doing that right now.
Yeah. I'm going to get rid of all my...
All this junk.
All this junk. All these fucking motors and all this infrastructure that I have. It's just going away.
So notice in that interview, too, with Randy, that he was off to work.
Yeah, that's right.
He was taking a break from work. And I assume he's a builder, right?
He is.
So he's probably pouring a slab or building a staircase or...
Yeah.
Who knows?
He's got a pretty interesting job, niche carved out in terms of like custom building. But yeah, that guy works really hard, and he's I've admired his career and his work for a long time.
Yeah.
He's definitely someone to emulate. And I think he's got a really good perspective on it all. You know, no expectations, just keep making work. I think he's really thoughtful about what he's doing and definitely inspirational. Yeah. So I don't know. Let's say, I think we could probably wrap it up here. So the lessons learned are, from my perspective, the art world doesn't give a shit about you. You just have to make work for yourself.
And you are a nobody until you make somebody. You're nobody until you make somebody money.
Exactly. And then, but you have to be okay with that. Like that's fine. You know, like as long as you recognize that, the market is capricious, that there's no, you know, there's no deserve, right? Like you make work that's either attractive to people or not. And it's arbitrary. You don't earn a place, right? Like you just make work and either people like it or they don't. Mm-hmm. And that you have sort of no control over that. Whatsoever. And you have to be okay with the fact that people may or may not like what you're doing, or that it may or may not, you know, like you might get gallery representation, or you might not. And it has nothing to do with how good or bad your work is at some level, I'd say.
Maybe I could qualify that up and down. I mean, I think you need to make work that is, you need to take into your calculus when you're making work, if you have any expectation of showing it and selling it commercially, that it be, like Randy was saying, like, you know, people are buying paintings, mid-sized paintings, you know.
Right.
Like medium-sized paintings. Why? Because
you
can put it in your home very easily. There's nothing challenging about it. It's going to be
the
rarer collector who will take on a work that's challenging to present, display, you know, forget about it, even explain or understand.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
Those kind of things can enter into your calculus as long as you don't feel like you've, you know, compromised yourself unduly.
Right.
There is maybe a point at which you need to modify what you're doing so that it can be.
And I think we've talked about this before. Like, was it self-protective of me to be doing installation art? As a way of saying, like, I'm not even going to enter into this commercial world, right? Like, I was definitely interested in making installation, but there's a level at which it's totally safe to do that, right? Because it's like from a put yourself out there perspective, right?
Right.
Now, that said, I don't think that was a big part of it for me. It was definitely in there. Like, if I'm really looking at myself, taking a hard look at myself, it is to a degree self-protective. On the other hand, because I don't have to worry about being rejected by a gallery, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, on the flip side of that, it's, you know, that was a very small part of it, I think. And I only came to that sort of after a lot of soul searching and really hard thinking and self, you know, introspection. Now I'm making work that, you know, now that I'm working with K Imperial, and I also am making work that I think is just a little bit more sophisticated than I was before, like using more, like instead of using paper, using canvas, right? So I'm doing these drawings, paint now, I guess you could call them paintings, on canvas. I think that there's a little bit more rigor there, you know? And the fact that they might be, that a gallery might be interested in them and that a collector might be interested in is great too. I don't think it diminishes the integrity of my work at all. In fact, I would say being thoughtful about this stuff has improved the quality of my work. And so I don't see it as, you know, it's like, oh, you're selling out your idea. It's like, no, it's just a refinement, you know? And that's like a sort of a naive or immature way of thinking about, you know, making. that I'm glad that I'm over. Because it's like, you know, this, it's not some pure heroic expression, right? It exists within a context of a market and within a context of a, you know, a long practice, you know. What is it, 7 years since I, when I graduated, 2005 or six? So it's 6 or 7 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, my thinking about my art practice has changed dramatically. Obviously, I'm not raising my hand now saying I'm going to make a living as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
I say I have a practice that I'm dedicated to and that I'm going to keep going whether or not I have any commercial success.
Mm-hmm.
And I just need to figure, you know, I have to navigate what that means in terms of my participation in the art world and, you know, the kind of work that I make. But I'll always make work, and whether or not it's commercially viable or I make, you know, whatever, that remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely see it as a long haul.
Yeah.
You know, and it's also interesting as like a 40, I'll be 44 and is that right? 44 in March. So it's like, what's an emerging, somewhat emerging or mid-career, you know, I'm not mid-career yet. I don't know, but like I'm old for, or I'm older, or we're older, you know, like mm-hmm. if we had gotten out of grad school when we were in our 20s, like maybe things would be different. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, you got to make it because you want to make it. And if people are interested, that's great. And, you know, I'm grateful to Karen and Amy for taking an interest in my work. And I hope that we can continue to work together. But my feelings also won't be hurt if they, you know, like they don't have my work up at the art fair.
Right.
It's fine. Like I didn't have any expectation that they even would. So it's all good, you know?
Can I share my experience last night?
Yeah.
And, it kind of fleshes out this, sort of like thinking about, you know, ways of being an artist. There's a collector, a print collector, who asked my wife and I to take part and basically provide artwork for a holiday party that he was having.
Mm-hmm.
He has this really beautiful home up in the Berkeley Hills in one of the fire zones, in the 91 fire. So he rebuilt it.
Cool.
This is like an amazing place, like amazing view of Golden Gate Bridge and the Bay Bridge. And he's an interesting guy. He invited us, and his girlfriend is part of a woodworking cooperative at Alameda Point. She and a couple of her colleagues from there were showing some furniture pieces and sort of like functional, like wood, really interesting, like functional woodworking pieces, like these like kind of intricately inlaid or assembled kind of like cutting boards and centerpieces and salad utensils and stuff. So Danny asked us to do this, and Danny owns some of Sarah's work, and he's been interested in my work over the years, although he always wants me to go back to making prints again.
Right.
Because he really likes my woodcuts. But, you know, it's like there was a point at which I had to like realize, like, you know, this is not my audience, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, although a couple people came that were interested in my work, and then I, you know, mainly people that I invited or,
right.
You know, I got sort of invited a select group. That's another way of showing art. You know,
yeah.
And that may result in sales. And actually, I sent it out to some people that have bought prints from me in the past. And this woman came who bought prints from me years ago, who I haven't seen in years, on some of my woodcuts back in the 2000s.
Right. Did she buy anything?
No.
But it was nice to invite her.
Yeah. And it was nice to see her and reconnect with her. And it was interesting. I ended up talking to this guy, Seth, who was one of the woodworkers, and he's a talked to him for a long time. Really interesting guy, probably in his early 60s. Who like he has a degree in German literature from UC Berkeley. Attended Cooper Union in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of this because he was talking about how all of his classmates. He was a little older. I think he was in his early 30s at that point. And then like his classmates were all like right out of high school. And he said none of them continued.
Mm-hmm.
As artists.
Right.
And we were kind of talking about why that was. And, and his theory was that basically like the New York art world, the 80s presented itself as this sort of like, you know, newly minted like art stars every 5 minutes.
Right.
So like, and if you're going to Cooper Union,
you're next in line.
And when that didn't happen, they just fizzled out immediately.
Right. Well, that's very interesting.
This guy was a little older, and he ended up actually studying furniture design after Cooper Union up in Mendocino somewhere.
He didn't get wrapped up in that.
No, he didn't, and he just makes custom furniture for a living. That's what he does.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And he's probably really happy.
He seems pretty happy.
Yeah. You know, we should do a survey with, like, the 3 years or 4 years of, like, so when I want to see if we can contact all the San Francisco State students that we kind of, that we overlapped with. Because it'll be like, so when I was a first year, the third and second years that were ahead of me, then my, you know, my year, your year, and then the people that you overlapped with after I was gone.
Right.
That would give
me.
Us a really big, that would give us a, what, that would be a 6 year
sampling.
That would give us a 6 year sampling. I'd be really curious to find out how many people are still making work.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, I can think, like, Carrie Hovey's an obvious example of someone who's, like, got a pretty good career going right now.
Yeah.
But, and
the
then...
The residency circuit.
Well, she's doing, I mean, she's living this residency circuit that's incredible. I couldn't live like that, but I'm glad that she can. But, like, Luna, I don't think makes work. I don't know about Shadi. You know, there's a bunch of people that I'd be curious to know what they're doing, if they're showing at all.
Yeah.
Like, so the question would be, maybe we'll work out the criteria. Like, are you showing? Are you making? And are you showing?
Yeah.
And, like, those are the two questions.
Yeah.
Right? Are you interested in that?
Yeah, sure.
I'd be also curious how that compares to, like, other schools, you know, to other art schools in the Bay Area. Like, if you go to CCA or Art Institute or Stanford or Berkeley, are you more likely, maybe we can enlist some folks from that we are friends with. It would be harder for CCA and Art Institute just because it's like the program produces so many people. But maybe we could look at Stanford and Berkeley. We could reach out to folks from Stanford and Berkeley, like Ken Lowe at Berkeley. And and maybe we could just figure out, you know, do a little bit of research. But that could be a good
Well, and you know,
project.
These schools probably research...
Some of them
probably definitely do.
Right, some of them do. I bet you CCA and Art Institute does.
Yeah.
But, you know, be interesting to know what their percentages are. So,
sure.
Cool. Good research project.
Right on.
All right, man, you feel good?
Yeah.
Who am I, Mark Maron? Till next time, this has been The Aphorists with Jesse and Anthony, and we'll talk to you next time.